Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. If you're a regular listener of this program, you're probably aware that Oklahoma's female incarceration rate is the highest in the nation, which really makes it the highest in the world since the United States has the world's largest prison population. Interestingly, in our current world of political gridlock, it seems that one of the few areas of bipartisan agreement is that our prison industrial system has become too bloated, too many fines leading to too many arrests, convictions, and imprisonments for seemingly illogically long prison sentences. My guest today, Robin Steinberg, has long been an advocate for individuals caught in the legal system. She's worked as a public defender for 35 years. In 1997, she founded the Bronx Defenders, a nonprofit group of now more than 300 staff dedicated to what she calls holistic legal defense, meaning not only working to prove a client's innocence, but to provide context for defendants and the social determinants that lead to criminal charges in the first place. Recently, through the auspices of local foundations, Steinberg has brought the Bronx Defender model to Tulsa. With the formation of Still She Rises, a public defense and advocacy group that focuses specifically on women that are mothers or caregivers and caught up in the criminal justice system. Robin Steinberg, founder and executive director of the public defense group, the Bronx Defenders, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Robin Steinberg, welcome to Medical Monday. Who are the Bronx Defenders?
So the Bronx Defenders is a not-for-profit, holistic public defender office that serves the South Bronx in New York City. We represent about 30,000 indigent clients a year, not just in the criminal justice system, but also in the immigration system, in housing court, in family court, in public benefits, in basically any of the arenas where our clients might find themselves. But it's rooted in the idea that we're public defenders in the criminal justice system representing our clients.
So when you say public defender, I tend to think of someone who's employed by the system, so to speak, whether that's the court or the Justice Department or this city. So help us think that through. So this is a separate, independent, nonprofit agency.
Yeah, one of the things that's unusual about New York is that New York City is actually, its indigent defense work is all done by not-for-profit organizations. So we don't have a statewide system or a county-based system that way. And the different not-for-profits exist to do the work for low-income people going through the criminal justice system in New York City. So the Bronx Defenders came out of that system. In 1997, we actually created the Bronx Defenders, and we'll be 20 in the fall. And obviously, we started with a very small group of 8 people, and we've grown to be a staff of over 300, serving about 30,000 people a year.
And then are the Bronx Defenders just one of many, as you point out, nonprofits that contracts with New York City and or the counties around New York to do this public defense work?
Exactly. The Bronx Defenders is unique in that the approach we take to public defense and that we've been developing and testing and pioneering all these years is called holistic defense. What that is it's grounded in the idea that people come into the criminal justice system, there are underlying causes that are driving them into the system. Some of them are personal, some of them are community, some of them are systemic, some of them are historic. And that once people are in the criminal justice system, there are devastating collateral consequences that can happen to them, from losing your home to losing your job, losing your benefits, losing even the care of your children, losing your right to stay in this country. And that what we try to do in our model is we use an interdisciplinary approach to the person who has been arrested, and we look at all of the different areas they might need advocacy and defense, and we provide that advocacy and defense in all those areas.
You actually anticipated my next question, which was why holistic and what that means. And I just want to make a note here that, in fact, that is why I thought you'd make a great guest on this program, because to me, the analogy to medicine and the direction medicine is going in is quite interesting. We talk about social determinants of health and what are really the underlying causes or roots of health problems, and how nowadays we're struggling, but we're trying to get to the place where we have more interdisciplinary teams that care for patients and try to address some of the underlying problems and not just, in a sense, put a Band-Aid on things. And so this really spoke to me. So did I read correctly that there's more of an emphasis on females in the system because who you defend, or is it exclusively?
In the Bronx?
So
in the Bronx, no. The overwhelming majority of our clients are men,
okay.
Because that reflects the population of people who are being put into the criminal justice system in New York City and who's being incarcerated. It's a very small percentage of women, actually.
Got it. Okay, but so there's a different emphasis in Oklahoma, correct?
There is a different emphasis in Oklahoma. And what we have really done is taken the model of holistic defense, right, which is designed to do the things we already discussed, and tried to bring it to Tulsa, Oklahoma, but to look at the question about how does holistic defense work for women in the criminal justice system here. And the reason that we decided to focus on women, obviously, is because Unfortunately, Oklahoma is the ground zero of women's incarceration. You incarcerate women here at a rate 2 times the national average. And that made it a really important and critical place to bring this model, but to really look at it and focus on the population of women.
Okay. And then you mentioned the holistic approach, that there are a number of reasons that could be legal, personal, I think you also said systemic. Mm-hmm. Unpack some of those for us. What might be examples of those issues? Like, I mean, you think about someone getting arrested or charged with a crime. How do you approach it as a public defender?
Sure. The holistic defender model is really designed to look beyond just the criminal case. And public defense is generally designed to really look at the person that you're defending in the system, try to understand what drove them into the system, put their act in the context of what's going on, both in their lives, in their community's lives, and in perhaps their longer history, and to try to sort of work in mitigation to understand why somebody might be in the position they're in, to defend them. Obviously, everybody who's arrested is not guilty of the thing they've been arrested for, but even if they are guilty of a crime, it's important to look at the context of how that person wound up in the system, because justice is really supposed to be about meeting out fair punishment. And that can only be really done if you look at the entirety of the circumstances and the context that a person comes into the criminal justice system in to mete out justice, right? It can't just be about convictions. It can't just be about throwing people in jail. Because if it is, you wind up being the largest jailer in the world, which we are. And I think we are finally, as a nation, beginning to have a larger conversation about what mass incarceration has led to. And it's led to not just the destruction of millions and millions and millions of people, predominantly low-income people and predominantly people of color, but it has also led to the entire disruption and evisceration of communities across this country. And I think finally we're beginning to recognize that. Holistic defense as a model takes all of that into context when you are looking at how do you defend somebody on the case. Of course, you do the analysis about the criminal case. Is there the evidence? What would the defenses be, right? But you're also looking more broadly at how did this person wind up in the criminal justice system? What services and support and advocacy can we put in place, right, to defend them and to actually try to stabilize them and their families and their communities?
So how, and I'm sure this varies by court and by degree, but how does the court or how does a court view extenuating or mitigating circumstances when, if in fact there's proof, I guess you could say, that a crime was committed? I could picture some judges saying, you know, letter of the law, this crime was committed, this is the sentence, here we go, versus a different judge who might think more holistically or might take into consideration extenuating facts and perhaps, you know, exonerate someone or give a lesser sentence? Is that a way of thinking of it?
It's not naive, but, you know, the promise of our Constitution and the promise of our legal system, right, is that people should be afforded counsel. That means meaningful counsel. People should be presumed innocent. That means really presumed innocent at the beginning. People shouldn't be incarcerated because they are from a low-income community or too poor to buy their way out of the criminal justice system. And that justice should be individualized, meaning judges and prosecutors ought to be taking into account the individual circumstances of people who come before them in meeting out what justice should look like, what sentences might look like, what would be a fair resolution of a criminal case, assuming that there is actually evidence to prove this person guilty. That's the great promise of our system, that kind of individualized assessment ought to be done. And a big part of that from the public defender perspective is to try to just not just assess the evidence that the government might have or not have against an individual, but also to be able to provide to the prosecutors and to the court information that puts that criminal act into context. Nobody should be defined by their own worst act. It starts at that level. And none of us would want to be defined that way. I always say to people when I'm talking, well, try to imagine the worst thing you've ever done in your life. And now imagine that that is the only thing people talk about you. You would be the first person standing up saying, but that's not all of me. I'm a good neighbor. I'm a good grandson, right? I'm a good sister. I graduated third in my class. You would be raising all the other things about your humanity, right, and your dignity that the system needs to know about, too, when trying to decide what's a proper sentence, what does justice look like. It's about not defining somebody by a piece of paper and not defining somebody by a single criminal act, but putting that act into a larger context. And part of that context is history. And part of that context is circumstances, right? Criminality, I mean, I've been a public defender for now 35 years. And I have learned, if I've learned anything, it is that criminality is almost never about character. It is almost always about circumstance. And some people say, well, that's just an excuse. It's not an excuse. It's context. And it's the same, by the way, context that anybody would demand if it was their son or their daughter or their brother or their husband or their sister that got arrested. We'd be the first ones in court going, but he's not just that petty larceny. He's also a member of the chorus. He goes to church on Sundays. He helped his mother when she was ill, right? We would raise those issues. And that's really what it's about. It's about providing context and to provide a picture of somebody's full humanity, not just the thing they're charged with.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Robin Steinberg. She's the founder and executive director of the Bronx Defenders, a public defense nonprofit agency in New York City. And Robin, you have piloted or really brought Bronx Defenders to Tulsa, as you mentioned. And here the program has a little bit of a different flavor, as you alluded to earlier, that the focus is on women. And the name of it is Still She Rises. So
that's right.
Where does that name come from?
So the name comes from a poem by Maya Angelou called And Still I Rise, which is just, I think, a beautiful piece of work. Almost everything that she ever put on paper was beautiful. And I thought it really captured what we're trying to capture here, which is that women coming into the criminal justice system here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, are facing incredible obstacles. They are facing historic marginalization. They are facing historic racism. They are facing incredible poverty. There's a very, very, very thin social safety net that exists for lots of our clients. They're coming from marginalized and under-resourced communities, and yet still they rise. And what I mean by that is their communities are still resilient and filled with family and love and hope and inspiration. Despite all those obstacles, even when facing those systemic obstacles that I think so many of our clients face, they still rise. And we want to be here to elevate those stories and to make sure that women continue to rise.
And so what's the setting here? I mean, my understanding is you work in the north part of Tulsa. Tell us about the calculus of where you're located and who you're serving.
So when we decided to do this project here in Tulsa, and we're very grateful for the support of the George Kaiser Foundation and the Zara Foundation and others who've helped make this possible, we looked around Tulsa to try to decide where would we want to place this office and what community would we want to serve. There are far too many women coming into the system for a small pilot project to be able to accommodate, right, and to be able to defend. So we learned a lot about the history of Tulsa. We learned a lot about where the need was greatest. It was hard not to trip upon the 1921 Tulsa race riots and to understand that the North Tulsa community that was ravaged by that egregious act of racial violence in this country has really never recovered from that, that it is still wildly under-resourced. It is still greatly marginalized. It is often ignored. People don't travel there. People have all sorts of, you know, horrible images and stereotypes about it, none of which are true. And we thought to ourselves, well, if we're going to place an office and we're going to serve women, we wanted to go where the need was greatest and in the place that was most under-resourced. And that was obviously North Tulsa. So we found a space in North Tulsa on 36th Street North and renovated the space and opened our doors on January 1st for clients. And we represent women from North Tulsa who are in the criminal justice system who are either mothers or primary caregivers.
So there's a specific focus on mothers or primary caregivers, which means you can't defend everyone. But that holistic approach, I think, speaks to the fact that mothers or caregivers are particularly vulnerable, and those for whom they care, in turn, are particularly vulnerable. So what kind of success have you had so far? What kind of outcomes? It's probably too early to know.
We're beginning to see where the areas of our advocacy are making a real difference. It is important to note that at least 80%, if not 85% of the women who are being booked into David L. Moss reception are mothers or primary caregivers.
80%?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that really is, it's quite easy to find women who are mothers or primary caregivers, and those are our clients. What we're really looking at and we're beginning to see in really obvious and clear ways are the intersectionalities of the different systems that are impacting these women's lives. So it's not just the criminal justice system. It's also the child welfare system, right? It's the family court system. It's the benefits system. It's the school system. It's the, you know, what we're beginning to unpack when we get a client is the various ways in which different systems are impacting women's lives. There is a very close connection between, for example, criminal justice involvement and then the child welfare system getting involved. So most of the women that we're defending wind up with having a DHS involvement, either an investigation or an actual case file to remove their children from their care. Lots and lots of the women are, you know, suffering from housing instability, from food scarcity, from a lack of social safety net and benefits to actually support them and their families. And so what we're beginning to really look at is where are the areas of impact for these women, what's driving them into the system, what's keeping them in dire circumstances, literally living on the edge of existence, a lot of them. And where can we provide advocacy for the women and the children that we're defending and representing and providing advocacy for? Where does it make a difference, and where can we see those changes? So we have traveled to housing court. We have been in family court. We have been in criminal court. We've been in municipal court. We've gone to small claims court. We are literally tracking wherever a client comes in. We will go wherever the need is for her and her family, and we will defend her and her family and provide whatever advocacy and social work support we can, too. We have a social worker who works on our team and civil legal advocates who are also embedded with the lawyers who are looking at the various areas.
What's the reception been for Still She Rises attorneys here in Tulsa? I mean, it must seem like, in a way, that you were sort of dropped here from another planet. I mean, you know, New York City slickers. You know, what's the reception been in Tulsa, Oklahoma?
So we like to laugh because the minute we meet somebody and we meet a new client, the first thing the client will say is, "You're not from here, are you?" And, you know, and I always answer the question by, "Is that because of the way I dress or the way I talk or the way I look that you know that?" But no, we know that we are outsiders and we know that we have come from another place. The beauty of that experience, though, is we're not here to judge. We're really here to provide fresh eyes and a new lens to looking at the criminal justice system, to looking at what's happening to women from North Tulsa in the criminal justice system. What does racial disproportionality look like in the criminal justice system? Where are the areas of impact for women and their children? How can we provide advocacy in those areas? What areas need to change? What can we do to actually raise these women up and stabilize their families and make sure that they're getting really, really strong and powerful advocacy that is tailored to their needs and tailored to their specific circumstances?
I want to come back to two things you've already mentioned because you cover a lot of ground. One is this idea of debt. So people get into the justice system, and I've read a lot about this, and I think sort of the average person might, you know, see this in the newspaper if you're someone who follows the news. But we've heard stories, certainly in the NPR world, so our listeners will know, about civil penalties, even parking speeding tickets, nothing on the criminal nature, where eventually failure to pay gets you into further trouble, subpoenas, warrants, arrests, things like that, and it becomes this vicious cycle of debt. So that's something that you're seeing, I would assume, firsthand here in Oklahoma as well?
It is not an exaggeration to say that 100% of the women that we have so far interviewed and defended in various places has had an enormous amount of debt from various places. Last year alone, there were over 2,000 people booked into the David L. Moss Reception Center for failure to pay fines and fees.
That was the only reason they were booked?
That was the only reason they were booked. The women that we have been defending, a lot of people come in from the community, and they're coming in. We had a woman who came in just today. The only issue she has in the criminal justice system is unpaid fines and fees. And what's important to remember, right, is that fines and fees are being imposed upon people from a low-income community who have no financial resources and no ability to pay it back. And this burden hangs over them, not just for days, not just for months, but for years and years and years. It results in warrants, it results in incarceration, it results in loss of jobs, it results in the inability to go to school. It literally affects every aspect of their lives. And it is as if we fail to recognize that when you impose a fine on somebody who comes from a low-income community, that money is not going to be recovered. And the question I always ask to myself is, it makes no sense to me that my bet is that the cost of enforcement to try to bring women that we're defending into the system to try to extract some cash out of them, the cost of enforcement probably is more than the debt they owe. And that debt just hangs out there. And it has enormous psychological, economic, and other consequences for them, with really very little hope of them paying it back. Not because it's willfully not being paid back, because literally it's the decision to, do I feed my child tomorrow morning, or do I pay $20 to this fee? And any of us would pick our children.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Robin Steinberg. She's the executive director, the founder and executive director of the Bronx Defenders, who have a program that has been on the ground here, open for business since January of this year, 2017, called Still She Rises, working out of North Tulsa, advocating for women who are mothers and primary caregivers for family members that are caught up in the criminal justice system. And we looked at some numbers. You said 2,000 people booked
just
David
last
Moss.
Year for just, failure to pay a ju- fine.
Oh, that was just for, okay, failure.
Oh, just for failure to pay a fine or a fee. Yeah, just in 2016.
So one of the other things you touched on is sort of this much more well-known concept of mass incarceration. I mean, lots of books about it, lots of press about it. And what's interesting to me is that this seems to be an area where there is some sort of bipartisan consensus in our country, that you have people a little bit on the right and certainly on the left, maybe in agreement. You're giving me a funny look that says maybe not there yet. But we're starting to understand at least the consequences, the downstream consequences of incarcerating so many people and the creation, really, and the inflation, if you will, of the prison industrial complex. So is there any reason for optimism here that we're going to reach some kind of political consensus to try to address some of these systematic problems or this massive growth in the criminal justice industry, so to speak?
I always have hope, right? I think I wake up every morning and I put on rose-colored glasses. I don't think you can be a public defender for very long if you don't ultimately think you're going to make a difference and that there's hope. Certainly, there is a changing narrative across this country about mass incarceration and the criminal justice system and the growing recognition that our criminal justice system is horribly inhumane, utterly ineffectual, and that it exposes a racial bias that should be really part of the national shame. It is capturing in its web low-income people from one end of the country to the next, and disproportionately low-income people of color from one end of the country to the next. And that is about time that we're talking about that, hopefully in much more clear terms, and beginning to roll back the get tough on crime years where we tried to incarcerate our way out of social problems rather than address the underlying issues of poverty and disenfranchisement and historic racism and all sorts of lack of access to resources that people should be entitled to have.
I'm curious about your own story. So you mentioned you'd been a public defender for 35 years. How did you get into the field? What made you decide to go into law? And, you know, maybe a little bit about your background.
So the last thing on my mind growing up was that I was going to be a lawyer. Just let me just get that out of the way. I was not one of those kids who grew up thinking, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer. In fact, the best I thought I might be is a nurse someday. Not to being a nurse isn't fantastic, but law was sort of out of my sights. I went to college and I was a women's studies major. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to work on issues that were affecting women. And I thought one of the ways to do that would be to do women's rights litigation. And so when I graduated college, I applied to various law schools with the absolute 100% conviction that I was going to do women's rights litigation. And I found my way to NYU Law School in large measure because they had something called a Women's Prison Project. Now, to be perfectly honest, I barely noticed that it said Prison Project. I was focused on finding a law school that had a program that was looking at the issues around women. And so I went to NYU Law School and I actually participated in that clinical program my second year in law school, which took me to Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, which is the maximum security women's prison in New York. And every week I would get on the train and go up to this prison and I would meet with my clients and we would talk about civil things that were affecting their experiences. They're not their criminal cases. So they'd already been sentenced and convicted and they were at Bedford Hills because of that. But some of them weren't getting adequate health care. Some of them had been the victims of abuse in the jails. Some of them weren't getting visits from child welfare to see their children that they were entitled to. There were lots of other civil issues going on and I began to represent these women on those cases along with my fellow clinic mates from NYU. And I have to say that there was a chorus of unhappiness about their public defenders, a sense that they had been railroaded by the criminal justice system. Few people even knew the names of their lawyers, and people were doing these women were doing unbelievable amounts of time behind bars. And I got to know them as vibrant, smart people who had an enormous amount to contribute and who cared deeply about their families and their communities and moving forward. And I was just surprised by the sentences that were being meted out, which got my interest in the public defender system. And I, in my third year of law school, then joined the Criminal Defense Clinic. And I will never forget the moment that I first stepped foot in criminal court in Manhattan and I looked around and I could not believe what I saw. And I describe it this way to people. You are either the person that is driving down the highway and you see a horrible accident and people are on the ground dying and bleeding, and you either are the person who stops and tries to do something about it, or you ignore it and keep on driving. And I couldn't keep going. The long lines of men and women, almost all black and brown, all low income, being chained together and being brought into this door at the side of the criminal courthouse building every morning, and then watching in the courtrooms as low income men and women of color from communities around New York City were being prosecuted for conduct that, quite frankly, I knew was going on in every community in New York City, but really was being targeted and people were being prosecuted in low income communities of color in New York City. And so conduct that I had seen myself and my, you know, fellow classmates and, you know, now I even look back and think about people's children engaging in where none of us were being arrested. Police weren't targeting our communities. People weren't doing stop and frisk in neighborhoods that affluent white people grew up in. And I recognized right away that something was terribly wrong. And I just had to do something about it. And so I began my career as a public defender at the Legal Aid Society in New York City. Ironically, of course, I wound up representing almost entirely men throughout my entire career until I had the opportunity to come down here and begin Still She Rises. So I like to say I've returned to my women's studies and feminist roots in helping to set this project up with my team, and I couldn't be more delighted.
Perhaps the circle is coming around. That's wonderful. People, I imagine, are going to be very interested in what you've had to say today. I mean, is there a way for people who are interested in criminal justice reform or helping or advocacy to get involved with either Bronx Defenders or Still She Rises?
Sure. So you can find us easily on our websites. The Bronx Defenders is www.bronxdefenders.org. Still She Rises is www.stillsherises.org. We'd be delighted to talk to anybody about the work that we're doing in either place. We're happy to have people volunteer. We're happy to have people help us fundraise. We're happy to engage with other lawyers about ways that we might be doing this work, and certainly with community members from North Tulsa who want to engage with us and help us learn. We're still very much in the learning process of what do women in North Tulsa need in the criminal justice system? What are the services that we need to provide? What kind of defense do they need? What kind of specialists do we need to have on board to really do the best job we can? And what are the systemic issues that are crushing these women and their families? And can we have some impact in pushing back some of those systems? Fines and fees that you raised is a really good one, right? What we know is that fines and fees are supposed to be determined on an individualized basis based on somebody's financial ability to pay. And yet, there is almost no systemic way in the courthouse that that finding is happening. That's unconstitutional, and frankly, it's immoral and inhumane. And what it winds up doing is burdening women from North Tulsa with children with unbelievable amounts of debt that they could not possibly find their way out from under.
So when I hear, you know, it reminds me of the medical model in the sense that you're helping individual clients and advocating for them, but then you see these much bigger systematic problems for which it sounds like Still She Rises or you as the executive director want to advocate for. So, and then thinking about it again in a legal framework, I mean, when you talk about something being unconstitutional, I look at either a sort of a broader suit or a class action or, you know, again, I'm very neophyte, as you can tell, with the legal arcana, but you're fighting parallel tracks. You're trying to advocate for the individual, but also, I think, you know, work to change the system. And that's got to be incredibly challenging work.
It's incredibly challenging. It's incredibly rewarding, although I always remind people the challenges that we face as the lawyers are incidental, right? The struggles and the challenges that our clients are facing, and frankly, that the North Tulsa community that's been under-resourced for so long is facing, are so much bigger than any of the challenges that we face as the advocates. But sure, it's hard work, and sometimes it's heartbreaking work. You know, the things that happen to our clients in the system, you know, reduce us to tears sometimes. They do. Sometimes the injustice can just make your blood boil. And that's all very challenging. But one of the things we learned at the Bronx Defenders that we also know here is any kind of impact issues and any kind of larger impact that you want to have has to be grounded in the things that you learn from your individual clients. So the women that we're representing in North Tulsa, that we're defending, have stories that inform us, that teach us what has to be done and where those areas of injustice and impact really are. So it's not about us determining that for other people. It's about elevating those stories and raising those voices of the women that we're defending and allowing the North Tulsa community to define for itself what the services are they need from Still She Rises and then following through with that. And some of that will be impact work and some of that will be individual representation. Some of that might be community organizing. Some of that might be legal clinics in the evening about certain issues that we see over and over again. We're still trying to figure that out and create an office that is most responsive to the community that we're serving and to the women that we're defending.
Robin Steinberg is the founder and executive director of the Bronx Defenders, and the new program that she's brought to Tulsa is called Still She Rises, servicing women who are mothers and primary caregivers in North Tulsa. Robin Steinberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.